My name's Anna Healy Fenton, as I'm sure you all know by now, and I'm the president of the club. We're very pleased to welcome today Sir Vernon Ellis on his whistle-stop tour of Hong Kong and Guangzhou. He only arrived yesterday, so he's bearing up pretty well. He's here to talk today about soft power and the role of the British Council, and I think probably in common with many of you, I'm not 100% clear about the many facets and attributes of the British Council and what exactly it does. So we're looking forward to hearing that. And he's just told me something which I didn't know, which was that every teacher of English in a Hong Kong school has done two British Council courses. So their tentacles reach far and wide, even in Hong Kong. So before I let him come up here, and he's been chairman for 18 months now and knighted last year, so he's had a very busy few months, just small matter of housekeeping, please remember to turn your phones back on afterwards. And next week, on the 4th, we have Gordon Matthews talking to us about Chungking Mansions, the ghetto at the centre of the earth. So that's next week's lunch speech. So please give a very warm welcome to Sir Vernon Ellis.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a huge pleasure to be here. I think the foreign correspondence clubs are often redolent with history, and this is no exception. And I understand I follow in the footsteps of luminaries such as Donald Tsang and the late Governor Chris Patten. Yes, British Council, what is it? I was rung up when I was on holiday in Argentina last year, having had no prior connection to British Council, and said, would you be interested in having your name go forward as one of the candidates for being chair of the British Council? So the first thing I did was look us up on the website and discover a bit more. But actually, having spent half an hour on the website, I was a bit confused. And so it's not entirely surprising that perhaps some of you can be as well. Our operations are quite widespread and a little sort of full of tentacles. A word on Hong Kong. Yes, I only arrived at 4:30 yesterday afternoon, but I've been kept busy since then. I had a fascinating dinner last night. And one of the things that I've just been checking this out with my journalist friends, new friends here, you know, is there a different mood in Hong Kong from when I was here 5 or 6 years ago? I remember I was speaking at a World Economic Forum conference at the conference center just below the Renaissance Hotel where I'm staying. And it seemed to me that although it's terribly superficial, making any kind of observation like this on the basis of a few hours' exposure, but nonetheless I'll make it, that at that time, Hong Kong was not as confident. There was SARS, of course, which was a major unknown threat, but also there was all the uncertainty from what was going to happen vis-a-vis Shanghai, other places in South China, what was going to happen politically, will this constitution stand up, etc. And since I've been here, I've been struck by two things. One is the vibrancy and optimism, which you can see around you, and the architecture you can see, when you can feel when you talk to people. And the second thing is the perhaps more cautious optimism, but nonetheless optimism, that this political arrangement, which is a very strange and unique one, can and should set to continue, and indeed become even more liberal, and become in a way a sort of beacon of where China might go. Now that's not to make predictions, and China, as you know, has many challenges in front of it. I will mention some of those later. But I want to talk a bit about what the British Council does under the guise of talking about cultural diplomacy, soft power. We are living in a time of extraordinary change, and during these challenging times, one might assume that the role of cultural relations, or so-called soft power, takes a back seat to rather more overt methods of resolution. But I believe, actually, it's precisely at these times that cultural relations can have most impact. When a sense of chaos reigns, the art of speaking softly on the ground amongst people can be more effective than yelling from a mountaintop, more effective than arm's-length wrestling between governments through diplomatic or even more aggressively military channels. We certainly live in an age of uncertainty. The new norm is perhaps there is no norm. We've gone from a unipolar world to a multipolar world, with discussions on the role of China, the BRICS more generally, and the end of an old order. And there's a sense around the world in different forms of unmanageable change, and of course, huge problems. The world is tremendously more connected now, electronically, trade, capital, people, but we're in a mess. Europe, of course, is particularly economically in a mess. We read headlines every day about Greece and Italy, Spain, the big French banks and their exposure. In the UK, we have these quite stringent austerity measures. Are they going to do the trick by eliminating the deficit, or is it going to push us into a period of non-growth indefinitely? We'll certainly see the effects of them for many years. America has perhaps the highest poverty levels in many years and deep, deep political contradictions at the top. And even in Asia, which is, by relatively speaking, hugely thriving, we still have the effects of this. For example, HSBC laying off large numbers of people as it tries to slim down. And China, as I mentioned, although the growth has been phenomenal and is now, and probably this is a good thing, a vital part of the world economy, a good thing because they have a shared interest with the rest of us. But nonetheless, faces economic and dislocation, difference in incomes, problems arising from migration, problems of capital adequacy of their banks, and a property market that is uncertain. And so we do face, and of course then actually to add to that, there's the Arab Spring, which perhaps causes some eyebrow raising and concern in this part of the world. But from everywhere, from the early arising in Tunisia and Egypt to the current events in Libya, it seems that change is on the way, but we're not quite certain of the outcome. So great uncertainty, great unrest all around the world. And of course, this has actually hit at the heart of the British Council. As you know, the British Council office in Kabul came under attack by Taliban forces, resulting in the tragic death of 12 Afghan security and police officers. And while it's a testament to the security and the safe room and the bravery of the security team that the attack didn't result in a full-blown massacre, the deaths are terrible and fill us with great sorrow. We don't bear arms. The lifeblood of what we do is cultural relations. One commentator described us as a tweed-wearing chamomile tea-drinking artists. But it's not a picture, actually, I recognize. Having traveled now quite a bit, British Council, you know, we did some heavy lifting in apartheid Africa. We were there supporting change right in the middle of a Cold War in Eastern Europe and had a very crucial role to play in Eastern Europe. We're in Nigeria, in Pakistan, Iraq. And yet we are feared, as we saw in Kabul. Why is that? Well, I think it is because what we do there is envied. In 1990, the term soft power was defined by a Harvard professor, Joseph Nye. And what he meant was achieving goals through trust and cooperation rather than through force or payment. So soft power has been described as influence, a flow of communication, reputation, as well as aspect of diplomacy. And in practice, it's a combination of all those things. So what does it get you? Well, not territory, but cooperation. And I think cooperation in the world is the currency we need most in this time. In a world of interconnected risks and interconnected trade and exposures, trust and cooperation will be most needed to get us out of the mess which we're in. Now, we've been focusing on this in our own way since we were formed in 1934, and we've always maintained that dialogue is really important. And we do that through a number of means, really utilizing great British assets. The English language is an asset. We do a lot with that. I'll talk about that. our higher education system and our education system generally is an asset, and our arts and culture a world. I've, despite my business background at Accenture, I've also been increasingly involved in a number of arts organizations over the last 10 years, and it's now a major part of my life. So let's look at these strands in a bit more detail and see if I can illuminate the question that I was posed, which, what the hell you do? They put it much more politely than that, but that was the essence of it. Or do you just teach English? Well, we practice soft power through, let's start with the arts. There's festivals, literature festivals all around the world. Hay, for example, we cooperate with a lot. Exhibitions, film contests. We know the arts are important to economic growth. The Edinburgh Festival, the largest festival of its kind, attracts 4.4 million visitors and generates about £100 million to the Edinburgh economy every year. I was there this year. We do a lot of things up there with them, and it's an amazing sight. And so part of what we do is just facilitating that, bringing great art and culture around the world, and I'll mention an instance of that, helping artists develop by more international experience, and that's two-way, not just a one-way traffic. But it's also, and I think I'm going to see, I want to see much more emphasis on this, actually helping develop skills and capacity in arts institutions. In many, many countries in the world, governments are putting a lot of money into arts and culture by building hardware, new facilities. There is less concentration on what's going to go in it, on the content. There is less concentration on can we develop sustainable skills that will help manage these effectively. Will we be able to attract new and young audiences to art forms? Will we be able to develop a sustainable economic model? In continental Europe, they had a background of having a high degree of state subsidy. That is declining rapidly. And there isn't yet a developed ecosystem around private investment in the arts that will help substitute for that. Unless that is developed, there's going to be a big problem. So I think we have a role. The British model of mixed funding for the arts, perhaps many might criticize it from within the UK, but actually when we look at it from outside the UK, it looks a pretty good model. The skills we have in the UK in the arts are very good. And in fact, I can't remember a time when the large arts organizations were working as well in terms of artistic output and in terms of absence of managerial and financial crises. Up to 5 or 6 years ago, always one of the big arts institutions in Britain was in financial trouble, always. There hasn't been an instance of that now for 5 or 6 years, and I could expand on why that it is, but I'll just leave it as a fact. We also practice soft power through the teaching of English. Indeed, right now there's about 300,000 learners in British Council teaching centres around the world, which delivers about 50 million export earnings for Britain. But more than that, we've already heard a mention of what we do in Hong Kong by training teachers, and there are massive leveraged programs in countries like India. We've taught about 5,000 master trainers on state-funded programs, which are reaching out to teach about 500,000 English language teachers, which are reaching out again to touch the lives of about 15 million children. I sat in a class in India, not of that program, but actually another program we're doing with Times of India, mentioning journalists, where we're taking volunteers from industry and training them to help teach late teenagers practical skills in English so they can get a better job out of the slum districts. And I went to one right in the middle of a slum district, and it was extremely heartening seeing this 59-year-old, quite senior manager from industry learning how to teach English with the tools we've equipped him with. That's making a difference. It's making a difference on the ground to people's lives, and I'll come back to why that's important. We also practice soft power through education and society. Higher education linkages are really important to us. We had a conference, we have an annual conference called Going Global. This is usually held in Britain. We held it here in Hong Kong earlier this year. 1,200 people arrived here from around the world, including very senior government delegations. And it's all about how to make higher education linkage really work more effectively. It's good for Britain, but it's also, I hope, good for the world. There's similar sort of programs linking schools. And in society, we try and get people talking to each other, usually with an aim. For example, earlier this year, there was a conference called Science, Culture and Modernity we held in the United Arab Republics, in Sharjah. And this brought together a whole wide range of people, young and old, to talk about issues like, can faith-based perspective bring an ethical dimension to science? These are tough subjects when you bring together people of different religions and societies, but they're important that we talk to each other about them. I was with the Prime Minister on the visit to China, to Beijing, last December, I think it was. And to give you a little, he came with me to a little, to two small examples of the work. I hope they give a sort of flavor of what we do. One was to a school outside in the countryside, outside Beijing. And we've been working with a great number of schools on climate change, and we have climate change champions. These are young people from high schools in Beijing. And you know, this young man I spoke to, it was the first time he'd been outside Beijing to go and teach in the school. First time he'd ever been outside Beijing. So it was quite an eye-opener here to be in a school, in a society which has actually got some real social problems because of the migration there is in China. The differences in languages and cultures is producing some real social problems. And so it was partly cultural. He had a big T-shirt on with British Council Climate Change Champion on it. And he was teaching these primary school people about it, and the Prime Minister came and he talked to them, and we talked to them, and the Prime Minister went there to present a rod from the UK exhibit, the pavilion at the Shanghai Expo. You may have seen pictures of this big dandelion thing with thousands of glass rods. Each of those glass rods had seeds in the end of it, so in a way it was a symbol of sustainability and protecting our ecology. And one of those rods, or at least a bit of it, the bit of the seeds, the Prime Minister presented to the school. Very symbolic, but very important. The other thing is we went to a school we are running for leaders of social organizations. There are about 60 people there in a room much like this. And the role there was we're helping those leaders, training them to lead social organizations more effectively, more entrepreneurially, to fundraising, etc. And that's important for lots of reasons, not least because China views such organizations somewhat ambivalently, to be frank. On the one hand, it recognizes they are needed because the social welfare net provided through the SOEs is dissolving. On the other hand, it looks at them with some apprehension because these may be focused for dissent. The same sort of attitude is in Burma. We run a program, World Economic Forum, called Global Changemakers, which takes incredibly talented people, young people in their late teens, early 20s, already running social organizations. And some of them go to Davos, and we have a big training session for a week in Britain. And I was talking to two young Burmese ladies who were there, and they both lead social organizations. And I said, is the government there equally ambivalent? And they said, absolutely. And in fact, although they tolerate us, we're not allowed to be called change makers. We're only allowed to be called global makers, which tells you something about the Burmese government. Where, by the way, though, the British Council has 1,000 people a day, mostly young people, 1,000 people a day visit our library in Mandalay and another 1,000 our library in Rangoon. It's a real beacon of light, and which is extraordinary in that rather repressed country. And of course, this soft power is not unique to Britain. Other countries, the French, the Germans, and indeed the Chinese through Confucius centers are fanning out around the world because they believe that's a way of building reputation and trust. And if you look at America, it's never formalized it through an institution, but after the war, Hollywood, brand names, films, television, made in many ways America the most trusted and respected nation in the world, and all of us imbibed in American culture. And we may learn something from how that's changed. So, soft power is exercised by bringing people together, face to face. And what's the outcome? Well, the outcome really we're trying to build is trust. It's trust through realizing opportunities. And the power of cultural relations, I think, is in summoning rather than projecting values. And ideologies which require violence and oppression to survive are indeed threatened by this type of work. And that's why the soft power of cultural relations most keenly felt by those most difficult or fragile locations. And that indeed reached its apotheosis, if you like, in Kabul. But we must continue to offer young Afghans the opportunity. They want it. They want practical education. They want English language skills. They want leadership skills. They want a more open society. And part of the challenge in Kabul was to have a location that was open enough to receive young people rather than the shelter behind high security walls. Sadly, we have to continue there, but we'll now be around higher walls. We've also got a very active presence in Middle East and North Africa and have done for 70 years since we opened our first overseas office was actually in Cairo in 1938. And as the people of Tunisia, Egypt, and now Libya demand more of their societies, it's essential we can reach out to them and forge new relationships and forge the kind of society that the Taliban seeks to destroy in Kabul. Now, people may ask, I want to close on saying, what's the value of this? You know, why not spend the money that's spent in British Council? And by the way, our turnover is about 700 million, under 200 million now is public grant, the rest is earned income. But nonetheless, that public grant's important. Why not spend that on reinforcing our diplomatic presence? Why not spend it on direct trade promotion? And when I started thinking about this, I was reflecting on my experience at Accenture. One of the things I did in my latter years at Accenture was to formalize and greatly expand our work in what we call corporate citizenship. It's reaching out, becoming active in society through giving, volunteering, pro bono work, etc. And I was often challenged by senior members of Accenture's management as to why this was worth doing. Why was it worth spending money on? And as I refined my argument on this, it seemed to me that it was something about reinforcing our intangible assets. Accenture, being now 180,000 people around the world, something like that, has to maintain its reputation. It has to have an attractive image in the recruiting marketplace. But more subtly, it also needs to increase its awareness of what's happening in the world around us. It needs to increase its sensitivity. And it seemed to me that the active promulgation of the sorts of activities we did in the communities and in developing countries helped all those intangible assets through a whole variety of programs which I haven't got time into. But it helped it obliquely. John Kay, the economist, wrote a book on obliquity. And what he meant by obliquity is some things are best pursued obliquely rather than directly. Happiness is an example. If you pursue happiness, you probably won't be happy. You become happy by doing other things, and as a result, you become happy. And this is true here, I think. And I used to have arguments with the marketing people at Accenture, who, when they found out something good, wanted to trumpet it and say, look how wonderful Accenture is. And I used to have to stop them, because I said, if part of the appeal here is to our own people, to our potential recruiting marketplace in the universities, then us trumpeting how wonderful we are is directly going to shoot that in the foot. And being marketing people, it took a few iterations before I got it through to them, because it's quite subtle. I'm probably insulting some people in the room, sorry. But it's a very important message, and I think that obliquity also applies to British Council, because British Council is about building trust, which are our sine qua non for relationships, including trade relationships, and we do that by providing opportunities, and so doing, reinforce intangible assets of Britain, such as our reputation, our attractiveness for relationships and inward investment, our ability to understand each other and other cultures, our ability to build partnerships, and the value of openness, encouraging expression of opinion, which is a building block for an open democratic society. So in summary, what we're about is building opportunities that help build trust and attractiveness in the UK. And, you know, this can work where politics fail. It provides an operational space distinct from the kind of policy advocacy which may cause mistrust. And now more than ever, things like arts and culture have a role to play. And in that regard, I'm pleased to not announce, because it's already been announced elsewhere, but to reinforce for Hong Kong a festival of UK arts, which will take place during next year. It's really at the same time as the Olympics. It's forging links between China, including Hong Kong and Britain, through arts and culture. And it'll be one of the biggest celebrations of arts and culture that there's been in China ever from the UK. It'll run from April to November and build on our successful Shanghai pavilion and celebrate the passing of Olympic torch from Beijing to London. We'll have a really big presence with maybe over 100 events across 15 cities. And in China, in Hong Kong, we'll have things like the Rambert Dance Company, Rock Archive, picture exhibitions of pop rock, an exhibition of Clive Barder's wonderful photographs of musicians. We hope to be able to finalize an exhibition of Grayson Perry, one of our finest current ceramicists, and also a big dance, which is a big community dance project, and more. So this will be a big celebration, and I think that's a very important part of our work. And of course, here in Hong Kong, you are on the start of a remarkable, ambitious development, the West Kowloon Cultural District, which is very visionary, very ambitious. And I was meeting with Michael Lynch this morning, talking about the kind of support and cooperation that we can do. So in the end, I just want to end with sort of an analogy drawn on my own experience. Because of my background in the arts, I've been particularly in opera. And of course, opera is bringing together of text, drama, a libretto with a musical score. And although operas can be performed and are all over the world with the same music and the same librettos, the result they can have on the audience can be very, very different, depending on whether they engage, resonate, seem relevant, or it's just a lot of stiff corpses singing nice tunes. When it's at its best, it can be wonderful, magical, uplifting. And that's because the interpretation has been infused with the human spirit. And that's really what I think is an analogy for using soft power. We're using well-known tools of culture, education, English, but hopefully in a way which has a lasting effect in creating those opportunities, building trust, and not only will the result be, I hope, a better world, but also a world in which Britain can hold its head high around the world. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Oh, hang on, Kenny, have I got this right?
Yes.
Okay. Usual drill, everybody. Please identify yourselves when the microphone's passed to you.
Good afternoon. Amanda Snow from Lloyd George Management. Thank you for a very interesting and inspiring speech about what the British Council is doing. I would like to know a little bit more about what you're doing to support legal education and legal developments, because I think, particularly looking at Hong Kong since the handover, and I arrived here in 94, our legal system with its British inheritance is still regarded as very important. In China, when you travel, you can see that people are trying to build up a legal system which gives them some protection from an autocratic society. Britain has one of the most widely respected legal systems in the world, and I think that that can be an inspiration to many people who want to build a strong civil society.
Well, thank you. I think this is a most interesting area, and I gather from Andrew Seaton that actually we've just had in Hong Kong a visit from four members of the UK Supreme Court. And also he tells me that there is significant interest
from China's judiciary about the system you have here. And as with many things, although Hong Kong perhaps is small in relation to the whole of China, it's particularly interesting in its role as perhaps an example of how things might become, I stress might. As to what the British Council does, we have no, as far as I know, Peter may correct me, I don't think we have a formal program on legal things. We do work with social justice systems. I saw the most interesting and extensive work in Nigeria through their social justice system, reinforcing the court systems, reinforcing the way policing is done. And I mean, it was really inspiring. This is a contract we're doing for DFID, Department of International Development. And I would like to see us do more there. And I think it ties to a wider thing, which is that actually, if you take, for example, exams, we have a big exams business, which is mostly English language exams, but there are also professional exams for certified accountants, for example. I think there's actually, and that's the interesting thing, exams are a big money earner. Now, why is that? Well, it's because actually, amongst others, people trust us to have a safe environment in which you can turn up, not have corrupt examiners, and do a proper job taking the exam. And I think that it could extend to many other professions. If you start doing that, you then start saying what lays behind that in terms of skill building. And I think the legal area is a very interesting thing. As far as I'm aware, it's not one we've explored on a global basis, and Peter's nodding his head. But I think you do raise an extremely interesting point. Thank you.
Hi, Craig Smith with PCGH. Given the deaths in Kabul, do you think that there are times and places that soft power ought to take a back seat and that it's not worth the sacrifices until the situation stabilized?
Well, obviously incidents like that raise that very question. And I mentioned that we were in a compound, not without security. There was security, quite a lot, but not as much security as there was in the embassy. Although, as we've seen by the attack on the US embassy, that too is not invulnerable. And if you have to retreat into a barricade so that you can't be welcoming to young people, then you have to question the viability of it. That's what we're doing at the moment. But longer term, in that kind of thing, we have to evaluate it. And this is an interesting and tragically an incident that will give rise to that kind of question. And of course, there are conditions in society, if they're not met, you can't do anything. The tragedy is that although it's relatively early in a country like Afghanistan, we've seen in Iraq and our work with skills building particularly, that it's hugely needed and hugely welcomed by young people. I mean, the Taliban virtually destroyed the education system in Afghanistan. Somebody's got to rebuild that education system. Somebody's got to do that. And if it's not done, then there won't be a sustainable Afghan society except along traditional Taliban ways or tribal lines. And maybe that's the only fate of Afghanistan. But to say, well, it's too difficult, too dangerous, we'll let you get on with it, is a bit defeatist, but nonetheless, you raise a question.
Okay, thank you. Over here.
Gavin McDougall, I'm an FCC member. As you pointed out, and any number of reports and studies point out, there is perhaps a growing role for soft diplomacy and the ability to be able to project soft power or cultural diplomacy. But that also comes in a time where cultural diplomacy is obviously and often an easy target for those who control the public purse strings. How do you rationalise that conundrum, if you like? And the second part of my question is, as Edward R. Murrow, after who a public diplomacy institute in the United States is named, once famously stated, there's no cash register that rings when a man changes his mind. In an area where you do have to justify your spending and there's a greater need for accountability on the spending of public funds, how do you demonstrate measurables when you're operating in an environment, as you describe it, of great obliquity?
Another very good question. and there's no simple answer. I mean, there really can't be a simple answer to that. If it was, we'd have found it. We do measure quite assiduously, actually, intermediate targets. How many people do we reach? How many people of different tiers in society do we reach? How many people do we teach? How many people visit exhibitions we go? And all that's quite monitored, and of course trends in that are useful, because if they're going up, that's probably a good thing. If they're not going up, that's probably not a good thing. But they don't get to the heart of your question, of course, as to how do you value it. And just as I found at Accenture, it's hard to put this into straight economic terms. We have the same difficulty, probably a good deal worse. And I think that we have to continue to be articulate in ways, to be honest, we haven't always been in the past. We've sort of done great work and people know us locally, and so we carry on doing great work. And particularly in the UK, who pay the public purse, we've rather ignored from a public relations point of view. In fact, there was a previous Director General, as they were called then, not very long ago, who believed any money spent in image in the UK was a waste of money, because we were given money to go and do good abroad. Now, I think that was a purist but self-defeating proposition, because unless we are articulate about what we do, why we do it, and what impact we're making, and probably not in precise economic terms, but at least as precise as we can be, then we can't expect to be given money from the public purse. And where we are now is that we have a Prime Minister, we have a Foreign Secretary, certainly, who do understand what we do and support it, but maybe we're not always front of mind enough, and maybe always, you know, we're in vulnerability of when they have to make public sector cuts, as they've had to do, they won't mind us cutting. I want to be in a position where we're viewed as so important we wouldn't dare cut it, and we're not there yet, actually. It will require a change to be there. But I think, and I really am genuinely convinced of this, and having said no, nothing about it 8 months ago, I believe the work we're doing is so important that actually it should be supported by the public purse, as well as us earning commercial money, because we are important to the UK.
Okay. Over here.
My name is Paul Surtees. My question is on the vision thing. Now, you've shared with us a few snippets about the marvellous job that the Council has been doing around the world and a few things that they're going to do in the future. And you've shared with us one or two of the transformations you've thought about in previous positions. Would you please share with us your vision? What would you like to change about the British Council in your time as the leader?
Well, when I became chair, and sometimes you bring no knowledge, but sometimes the perspective of being an outsider, it seemed to me that there were three things we needed to work on. One was to clarify what the purpose was. And that didn't mean alter it, that just meant getting better words. And that's quite hard for something quite complicated, but I think we've improved, more to go. Simplify the organization. It got terribly complicated. As in an attempt to connect together the 110 countries around the world, get more synergy, more sharing, it's quite easy, and I found this at Accenture, to inadvertently add bureaucracy. You just add new layers, new functional needs, etc. And we've done quite a lot about it at British Council. And so part of the task has been simplifying. And the third is people. Doing a more thoroughgoing job in recruiting, nurturing, deploying people so that we have the best people in every location and we continue to produce the best. Not that we don't have good people, we do, but I think we can do an even better job. That's quite a long task. Allied to that are issues of brand, so we don't have to keep saying, what did we do? It's just known. We've certainly got to do that. And supporting things like technology. I don't think the vision in terms of what we do is going to radically alter, at least I don't see the need for it. How we do it, yes. Faced with cuts, for example, do we have a different kind of presence in some countries, for example, in Europe, hub and spoke systems, etc. And longer term, I think the thing we all need to get absolutely right, certainly looking beyond the current spending round to 2015 onwards, is the right high-level accord with the government on our role, which will probably be thrown into further perspective by further cuts across the board, unless Britain achieves an economic miracle in the next 2 or 3 years. And so there's going to be quite a few questions about how do we cut again. And I think by that time, I would like to see a very good understanding from the Prime Minister downwards about what our role is and how it's supported. So that's what I think I'm giving my focus on, rather than sort of look long term in the future about something that might look very different in terms of what we do.
Okay, thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to hog the last question. Having been here since the handover and not being British, I perceive a certain reticence in expressing Britishness, rightly or wrongly, that, as we mentioned before, we were talking about this earlier, that I don't see among the French. Do you think there is a sort of certain British shyness in post-handover Hong Kong?
I don't think it's restricted to Hong Kong. I think the French have always been assertive, and maybe, you know, they need to be, to keep their end up in an increasingly anglicised world. And it's not being dismissive of French, it's just that, you know, Frenchness, French used to be the core diplomatic language. French, there's a lot of attacks that would diminish the French, and therefore they have a very single cause of promoting Frenchness. I don't think we want to promote Britishness. We want to do the things we did for the reasons I did, which is a bit more complicated. And I think it goes back to the people. We have very good people doing this and have done it for many years in many cases. And their reward comes from doing it. And therefore, they haven't had the inclination or self-motivation to want to speak about it more aggressively or more forcefully. And I think without falling into the trap I mentioned before about marketing, I do believe that you put your finger on a real point, which is we have to make more of what we do. I am generally, as I go around the world, and I'm not saying that just because I'm chairman, I am generally hugely impressed by things I find, and I am often depressed because so few people know about them. So I think we have to change that.
Well, it's 2 o'clock now, so I'd like to say thank you very much to Sir Vernon. I think we've all learned a lot today. And we hope you'll come back and talk to us next time he's here.
Thank you very much.